This is an ABC podcast.
Across Australia, you're listening to Breakfast on RN.
Good morning and welcome to AAM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Ngunnawal country in Canberra. The death toll from the earthquake in southern Turkey and northern Syria is at 11,000 and climbing. In Turkey, where public criticism of the government is normally muted, anger is growing over poor preparations and a slow response. Across the border in Syria, hope's running out as aid is stuck at the border. The ABC's Sean Ribbenstein Dunlop is in the quake-hit city of Adana in Turkey's south.
On a hill of rubble several stories high, dozens of rescue workers are dwarfed by their gargantuan mission. For 3 days, they've been using cranes, hacksaws, and in many cases, just their hands to dig for survivors in this collapsed apartment complex. Now and then, they scream, "Be quiet," when they hear what could be a voice from within. I'm standing in a crowd of loved ones, their faces now blank more than 60 hours into this tragedy. Former teacher Sedretin Açıkalan has kept watch the whole time in case his friend, a high school principal, is found.
I'm trying to hear news about him and his family and hoping he is alive. They're still under the rubble. Only his wife's dead body was found. Him and his son are still in there. We want to know if he's dead or alive.
In a van nearby, Red Crescent volunteers ladle food for a ceaseless line of exhausted survivors, including 42-year-old tradesman Fatih Hazash, who travelled hundreds of kilometres to search here for his family.
My brother-in-law and my three nieces and nephews are in the rubble. We went to the hospital to see if rescuers got to them before us, but they weren't there.
And at this point, what are your hopes that they remain alive?
I have no hope at all because the system is broken.
In this country, criticism of the government is often muted, with protests banned and dissenters muzzled. But anger is growing over poor preparations and a slow response, despite billions of dollars in so-called earthquake taxes. This survivor, Sabiha Elenek, struck a chord yesterday when she begged authorities to let her save her family herself in the city of Malatya, because like many, she said no help was coming.
My in-laws' grandchildren are there. We are devastated. When it comes to the state, they say the state is here. Where is the state? Where have they been for 2 days? We are begging them, give us permission. We can take them out. If they don't come, for God's sake, let us do it.
With an election looming, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan visited a tent city near the epicentre today and accused his critics of lying about the emergency response.
On the first day, we experienced some issues. But then on the second day and today, the situation has been taken under control. We will never allow our citizens to be left out on the streets. I'm asking our people not to give the provocateurs an opportunity and only pay attention to the statements coming from the Disaster Management Authority. I also ask our press members not to allow them. Today is a time of unity and solidarity.
Here at least, there are now more than 60,000 aid workers, including teams from across the world. In neighbouring war-torn Syria, millions in aid is being promised from some, but rescuers are scarce. The health system is on its knees, and the cross-border aid supply from the United Nations remains blocked. This is Sean Rubenstein Dunlop reporting from Adana in southern Turkey for AM.
You might remember yesterday we heard from 33-year-old Gökhan, a Turkish man searching for his mother. She was in her apartment when the building crumbled in the earthquake. Reporter Oliver Gordon spoken with Gökhan for an update.
3 days in, Gökhan still holds some hope his mother is still alive.
I want to believe that, you know, still working on it.
Gökhan's mother and father were in their apartment when the earthquake hit. The room his dad was in remained upright. The room his mum was in crumbled.
My dad was here. My mum is another side. My mum's side is going down. Everything like witness coming from my dad. That's why he's so sad.
Heavy machinery is now combing through the rubble and twisted metal that was once the multi-story apartment block Gökhan's parents called home. But with some parts of the building still standing, it's a complicated job.
Because it's so dangerous because of the NRF building is up, NRF building is down. if you take the some material down stuff, another one is upstairs, is like it's gonna be go down.
Beyond the front line in Adana, other problems are emerging. Many, like 24-year-old student Chulin, don't feel safe returning to their apartments.
I think it's extremely risky.
She'll sleep elsewhere until she's confident her block is structurally sound.
We still choose to stay in the car. We have uncomfortable sleeps here and everything. We are aching. Our body's aching.
That's not the only thing keeping her awake at night.
I'm waiting to hear from that friend of mine who has been trapped under the building.
Like many across the region, she's desperately calling for help.
We need more hands than ever. That's all I can say. We need more help. We need more hands. We need more legs. We need more minds. We need more brains. We need more people with more energy than we have. But I don't know. I just feel lucky in personally to have survived it, to have been able to live in a car. When you imagine people who live on the streets, who have been living on the streets even before this disaster, I consider myself lucky still.
Back at his parents' devastated apartment block, Gökhan is also doing his best to remain stoic.
We will work so hard. Like 100 people is going to be here.
But as another hour in the freezing cold passes, the grim reality of what he may soon discover is dawning on him.
My mom is going to be like, I can't see that. I can't see my mom. Inshallah.
Turkish man Gökhan, ending that report by Oliver Gordon. Medicare turns 40 next year, but the universal healthcare system's under tremendous strain. When it started, Australia's population was much younger than it is now, with fewer chronic health conditions. Now, many of us know how hard it is to get a timely doctor's appointment. In some country areas, it's impossible. Hospital emergency departments are struggling because patients are going there instead, along with those needing help for acute problems. The federal government promised a $750 million injection into the Medicare system to fix it, and recently received a task force report on what it should do. The Health and Aged Care Minister is Mark Butler, and he joins us now this morning. Good morning and welcome back.
Morning, Sabra.
You've already said that Medicare is in the worst shape it's ever been. Some Labor MPs who are doctors, Mike Freelander and Gordon Reid, are worried about the lack of urgency in fixing this. Will the fix for Medicare be in the May budget, and when will Australians notice a discernible improvement?
Well, we are already acting on Medicare. A week or two ago, the Prime Minister and I were down in Tasmania with the Tasmanian Premier to announce a really innovative way in which we'd support new GPs, so GPs in training, particularly in rural and regional areas where the GP shortage is most acute. Last week, we were in Perth announcing the rollout of our first tranche of urgent care centres, so 50 of them around the country, bulk build, extended hours, dealing with those non-life-threatening emergencies that too often see people having to go to an emergency department, which is frankly not necessary. So we are acting, but I completely understand the impatience of people like Mike Freelander and many others, passionate advocates for good health policy in this parliament. There will be a delivery of the $750 million package in the May budget. We've said that and we're committed to that, and it will reflect and be guided by advice from the Strengthening Medicare Task Force. But I want to be honest that we're not going to fix Medicare in one budget. I've tried to be really clear with people, this is long-term focused work that we're committed to as a government.
Being honest too, when will Australians know and feel a real difference with it?
Well, as I said, there are measures that we're putting in place this year to ameliorate what people are dealing with right now. But we need to do a whole host of things. We can't just put more money into the existing Medicare system. As you say, it was designed for a very different health profile in the country, where you went to a doctor with short episodes of illness that were fixed and then you didn't come back to your next episode. It's very different today with an older population with much more chronic disease, much more mental health issues in the community as well. So we've got to remake Medicare as well as deal with some of the financial pressure on it after 6 years of a Medicare rebate freeze that Peter Dutton started.
The Grattan Institute, a report found late last year that Australia has more GPs per person than ever before and more GPs than most wealthy countries with record numbers in training. Will your changes look at how to get doctors to the areas where they are needed most? rural areas, outer suburbs?
We've already started doing a little bit of that. There were changes made by the former government that pulled GPs away from some of our regional centres in particular that we sought to reverse. That really aggravated an already existing shortage in, for example, the Hunter Valley was an area hit very hard. The other thing we need to do, though, is to make sure our GPs are being used most effectively. There are many tasks that Medicare requires GPs to do that, frankly, should be done by practice nurses and by allied health professionals. That was a very big focus of the task force. So how do we make sure that we're using every healthcare professional, not just our GPs, in the most effective way, using the fullest extent of their skills and training? And that means GPs as well. So instead of GPs doing tasks that could be done by a practice nurse, they can focus on those long, complex consultations with the patients who've probably been coming to them for years and really need very focused work.
That task force does talk a lot about that blended healthcare model. I'm not sure that people really know what that is. It's having sort of teams under one roof with doctors, nurses and other allied health professionals all working together to care for patients with chronic conditions. Some doctors, though, are pushing back against that idea because they want to be in charge. They don't want to sort of give up that power. How are you going to overcome that turf war? But not only that, we've got a huge workforce shortage anyway. You're going to struggle to find those extra allied health professionals.
Well, we do, and there's increasing demand for healthcare. Leave aside the impact of the pandemic, which has been substantial. Even before that, the demand for healthcare with an ageing population, rising incidence of chronic disease, as is the case in every developed country in the world, has been increasing, and our workforce hasn't been keeping up with that. There's no question about that. But at a time of increasing demand and constrained supply of workers, the point I've made is it doesn't make sense not to have every single healthcare professional operating to their fullest extent. And the current myriad of regulations and turf wars and, you know, all of these historical battles has to end. It just has to end. And when I talk to individual doctors, they want to be able to work at the top of their scope of practice. They want to be able to delegate a whole bunch of functions which can and often should be performed by other healthcare professionals. So if you're a diabetes patient with chronic type 2 diabetes, yes, you want your care led by a GP, but you often want the different services you get coordinated by the local practice nurse who you know very well. Those services will include, you know, work by a podiatrist, work by a diabetes educator, perhaps an exercise physiologist. We've got to design a system that allows all of those people to be working together as a team, seamlessly as a team, and the system doesn't work that way right now.
Respected public health authority Stephen Duckett says the healthcare needs a lot more money than what you're promising, an extra $250 million per year. Is there a chance of that money coming, or in these financially constrained times, that's it?
Well, I've been clear that these are financially constrained times. There's no easy money lying around in the federal budget. I think everyone in health understands that, as they do beyond this portfolio. But, you know, I've been very clear, this is not going to be fixed in one budget. You know, we will have to keep working at improving and strengthening Medicare, because there have been 9 years, frankly, of neglect and, in many cases, real cuts that are putting it in, I think, its most parlous condition it's been in its almost 40-year history.
Medicare rewards doctors for speed rather than need. Are you considering the idea of an independent rebate tribunal to set fair indexation payments, to take it out of the government's hands and into an independent's hands?
No, that wasn't the subject of any discussion in the task force. It's not on the table right now.
Mark Butler, thank you so much for joining us. We'll have you back to discuss aged care.
Thanks, Sabra.
The UK is considering sending fighter jets to Kiev after a surprise visit by Ukraine's president. Volodymyr Zelensky spent the day in London on only his second trip outside the Ukraine since Russia launched its invasion almost a year ago. He thanked Britain for its support so far and appealed for more military aid, in particular planes. But Russia's warned of consequences if the UK sends jets to Kiev. Michelle Rimmer has this report from London.
Dressed in the khaki fatigues that have become his presidential uniform, Volodymyr Zelensky was greeted on the tarmac with a hug from Britain's Prime Minister. The Ukrainian president made a short appearance at Downing Street.
Do you miss Boris, Mr. Zelensky?
Before taking to the stage in front of a large crowd of politicians inside Westminster Hall.
We know Russia will lose. And we really know the victory will change the world. And this will be a change that the world has long needed. The United Kingdom is marching with us towards the most, I think, the most important victory of our lifetime. It will be a victory over the very idea of the war.
President Zelensky gave the Speaker of the House a fighter pilot's helmet and thanked the UK in advance for sending powerful English planes.
We have freedom. Give us wings to protect it.
But the UK currently has no plans to send planes. Until now, NATO countries have denied Ukraine's repeated requests for fighter jets, but that position could change. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has committed to training Ukrainian pilots to fly NATO jets and asked his Defence Secretary to look into what jets the UK may be able to send.
When it comes to fighter combat aircraft, of course, they are part of the conversation. Indeed, we've been discussing that today and have been previously. And that's why we've announced today that we will be training Ukrainian Air Force. Nothing is off the table.
Russia's embassy to Britain has warned of serious military and political ramifications for the entire world if the UK does send fighter jets to Ukraine. The Kremlin gave a similar warning before the West agreed to supply modern battle tanks and other advanced military technology to Kyiv. So far, it hasn't followed through on those threats. This is Michelle Rimmer in London reporting for AM.
Investigators say there are strong indications Russian President Vladimir Putin decided to supply the missile that separatist fighters used to bring down flight MH17 over eastern Ukraine in 2014. 298 people died in the attack, including 38 Australians. But the Dutch-led investigation teams found no evidence President Putin ordered the plane to be shot down. Europe correspondent Steve Kinnane reports from The Hague.
That's the sound of an intercepted phone call between Russian President Vladimir Putin and Igor Plotnitsky, the then head of the self-proclaimed Luhansk People's Republic. The pair were discussing the state of the war in eastern Ukraine in 2014, in contrast to claims previously made by Russia that it didn't have any involvement in the conflict in the Donbass. The evidence gathered by the joint investigation team, made up of five countries, including Australia, has found that not only was Moscow involved, it's highly likely President Putin authorised Russian missiles be sent over the border and into the hands of separatists. Andy Krag is a Dutch member of the investigation team.
Intercepted conversations reveal that the decision about whether to provide military support lay with Putin. There is also specific information showing that the request to supply the separatists with heavier anti-aircraft systems was submitted to Putin and that the request was granted.
The joint investigation team also tried to find out who was directly involved in the firing of the missile that brought down MH17 and who gave them their orders. The findings suggest members of the 53rd Brigade of the Russian Army were involved, but not enough evidence could be found to launch further prosecutions. And Dutch prosecutor Dignar van Boltselaar says for the moment at least, President Putin won't be prosecuted either.
Because at this moment, Putin is still head of state. He is head of state. He has an immunity.
Prosecutors say that all leads for the moment have been exhausted and that after 8.5 years, the investigation will be suspended. Paul Gard lost his parents, Roger and Jill, in the attack on MH17.
There is obviously some disappointment amongst the families. I think that we don't have the answer to the question why the plane was shot down. It has focused much as much as it can on the mechanics of how the plane was shot down, but the answer of why it was shot down is something that may never be known.
Ukraine has not given up. Its prosecutor general says the country would seek to employ all the existing international legal mechanisms to bring Putin to justice. This is Steve Kinnane reporting from The Hague for AM.
And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. If you haven't had COVID or a booster shot in the last 6 months, chances are you're more vulnerable than you think. In a few weeks, a fifth dose of a COVID vaccine will be offered to anyone over 18. Today, epidemiologist Catherine Bennett on how we're entering a new phase of the pandemic. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.